A waltz by Johann Strauss Jr., Voices of Spring. That was Willy Boskovsky and the Vienna Philharmonic.
You are listening to WHFR Dearborn, broadcasting out of Henry Ford Community College, and thank you for tuning in to this beautiful classical programming. We appreciate your continued support of WHFR, and if you would like to learn more about some of the events and activities going on through our radio station, our public non-commercial radio station, we would love to put you on our WHFR Loyal Listener mailing list. It is free of charge, and it's a bi-monthly publication that gives you the latest of places we're going to be, different show changes, schedule of events, that kind of thing. Simply give me a call, Susan McGraw, WHFR General Manager, 313-845-9842. That's 313-845-9842. Just as simple as that. Wouldn't you like to become a WHFR loyal listener? Well, you probably already are, but now let's make it official with a WHFR free loyal listener mailing list.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. We're bringing you non-commercial radio from Henry Ford Community College.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. Where local investigators as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. And for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. This is WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And today we will examine the UFOs, past and present. Back in the 1950s, UFOs were viewed as fringe science by most of the world's population. Most, that is, except for those who had witnessed these strange craft up close and personal. In 1950, the well-respected, no-nonsense journalist, TV anchor, and radio host, Edward R. Murrow, took a non-biased look at the subject. And our own Jay Kornick, host of WHFR Journal, stumbled across the old radio show and was kind enough to make a copy of it for me to play on the air today. So this is a rare piece of nostalgia, so I'm going to play it in its entirety without interruption. So then, from the 1950s, here is Edward R. Murrow.
This is Edward R. Murrow. We're going to talk about flying saucers. We're going to talk about them from the standpoint of reporters, not as comedians, not as sensationalists. For the past 3 years, a large number of perfectly sane and reliable people have been involved in this flying saucer business. Even those of us who have never seen one have become involved. We read about them, talk about them, wonder about these reports of strange phenomena in the skies. So almost from the start, CBS has been following the story. We have been collecting material on flying saucer observations for many months, checking, cross-checking, trying to track down leads, no matter how far afield they took us. This, tonight, is our report. We frankly admit that we don't know whether flying saucers actually exist. We've never seen one. We are going to bring you the facts at hand. What they add up to? Well, that's for you to decide. That's up to you. It all began just a little less than three full years ago. It began in the sky over western Washington, up there in the hip pocket of the country. Early one June morning in 1947, a C-46 Marine transport with 32 Marines aboard, crashed in the vicinity of Mount Rainier. An air search was immediately organized to locate the downed plane. Among the many service and private flyers who participated in this search was Mr. Kenneth Arnold, a businessman of Boise, Idaho, a veteran pilot in forest fire control work, a man with 6 years' experience flying over the rugged terrain in and around Mount Rainier. Yesterday morning, we spoke to Mr. Arnold over the phone. We asked him to repeat for us, in his own words, what he saw in the sky over Mount Rainier on June 24, 1947. We recorded what he said, and we're going to play it for you now. The slight beep that you will hear intermittently is required by law to let both parties of a phone conversation know they are being recorded. Here now is Mr. Kenneth Arnold.
It was while I was searching for this crash that I noticed a terrific blue flash pass nose of my airplane. I noticed that the flash came from a chain of very peculiar-looking objects that were rapidly approaching Mount Rainier at about 107 degrees. This chain of objects were nine in number. I assumed at the time they were a new formation or a new type of jet, though I was baffled by the fact that they did not have any tails. It passed almost directly in front of me, but at a distance of about 23 miles, which is not very great, in the air. I judged their wingspan to be at least 100 feet across. Their sighting did not particularly disturb me at the time, except that I had never seen planes of that type.
Mr. Arnold, after landing, made a routine report of what he had seen to a Civil Aeronautics Administration representative, promptly forgot the matter, until the wheels of publicity began to turn. The floodgates opened.
I never could understand at that time why the world got so upset about this, as these things didn't seem to be a menace. I believe they had something to do with our Army and Air Force.
On three different occasions, Mr. Arnold was questioned by military intelligence. They expressed doubt as to the accuracy of some of his reported observations.
That's right. Now, of course, some of the reports they did take from newspapers, which did not quote me properly. Now, when I told the press, they misquoted me, and in the excitement of it all, one newspaper and another one got it so ensnarled up that nobody knew just exactly what they were talking about, I guess.
Here's how the name Flying Saucer was born.
These objects more or less fluttered like they were, I'd say, boats on very rough water or a very rough air of some type. And when I described how they flew, I said if they flew like you take a saucer and throw it across the water, most of the newspapers misunderstood and misquoted that, too. They said that I said that they were saucer-like. I said they flew in a saucer-like fashion.
And that was an historic misquote. While Mr. Arnold's original explanation has been forgotten, the term flying saucer has become a household word. Few people realize that Mr. Arnold has reported seeing these same strange objects in the sky on three other occasions. He says that some pilots in the Northwest have reported seeing them on eight separate occasions. We asked for his own personal opinion on the nature of what he and the others had seen.
I don't know how best to explain that. I more or less have reserved an opinion as to what I think, naturally being a natural-born American. If it's not made by our science or our Army Air Forces, I'm inclined to believe that it's of an extraterrestrial origin.
Extraterrestrial origin? You mean you think there's a possibility they may be coming out of space from other planets? I suppose that's pretty hard for people to take seriously.
Well, I'll tell you this much. All the airline pilots, none of us have appreciated being laughed at. We made our reports essentially to begin with because we thought that if our government didn't know what it was only our duty to report it to our nation and to our Air Force out of it. I think it's something that is of concern to every person in the country. And I don't think it's anything for people to get hysterical about. Now, that's just my frank opinion of it.
So that's how it all began. That was the trigger action. Kenneth Arnold's story went scudding over the news wires, radio and newspapers picked it up, and then within days, the country broke out into a flood of flying saucer observations. Many of these reports, a great many of them, obviously could be discounted. Others, reports from perfectly competent, sober, and reliable observers, found no easy answer. In the face of this, late in 1947, the Chief of Staff of the Air Forces, at that time General Carl Tui Spots, sent a directive to the Air Materiel Command, located at Wright Field, Ohio.
The Air Materiel Command is directed to set up a project whose purpose is to collect, collate, evaluate, and distribute to interested government agencies and contractors all pertinent information concerning sightings of phenomena in the atmosphere, which can be construed to be of concern to the national security.
Remember, these were trained observers, Air Force men.
The objects reportedly traveled in a straight line, taking the mean reported speed, 350 miles per hour, and the time in sight, 1/2 hour. The objects must then have traveled 175 miles while in sight. If the objects were of such proportions as to be seen at that distance, it is believed that more details could have been observed at the first sighting.
And the Air Materiel Command opinion on the Muroc Air Base sightings was this.
This report is a result of misinterpretation of the nature of real stimuli, probably research balloons.
Another report on January 7th, 1948. Tech Sergeant Quinton A. Blackwell, chief operator of the control tower at Godman Field, an Air Force base at Fort Knox, Kentucky, spotted a strange object hovering over the south portion of the field. In a matter of minutes, a flight of four P-51 fighter planes approaching the field were contacted by radio and asked to chase the object. Leader of the flight was Captain Thomas F. Mantell, Jr., a veteran of the Normandy invasion with some 3,000 flying hours to his credit. At 2:45, Mantell reported by radio.
Object directly ahead and above and moving about half my speed. Going up to take a look.
At 3:15, Mantell reported again.
Object still ahead and above. Moving at about my speed or faster. 360 miles per hour. The thing looks metallic and is of tremendous size. I'm trying to close in for a better look.
By now, Mantell and his flight were at about 15,000 feet. They had no oxygen equipment. At 18,000 feet, the escorting planes turned back, but Mantell kept climbing. His next report came from 20,000 feet.
Going to 25,000. If no closer, we'll abandon search.
That was the last report from Captain Thomas Mantell. At approximately 25,000 feet, it is believed he blacked out for want of oxygen. His plane climbed another 5,000 feet and then went into a dive. When it crashed, parts of it were scattered around an area covering 1/6 of a mile. Project Saucer's conclusion.
It seems probable that the object observed was the planet Venus.
Later, in a report dated April 27, 1949, this conclusion was reversed. Further investigation showed the elevation and azimuth readings of Venus, and the object, as reported at specified time intervals, just didn't jibe. The object Captain Mantell chased to his tragic death is now officially marked
unidentified.
In all, Project Saucer investigated 375 cases. The report takes in 244 different observations. Just yesterday, we asked Major General William F. McKee, Assistant Vice Chief of Staff, United States Air Forces, to summarize the conclusions reached by Project Saucer. He said,
during 2 years of thorough investigation, no evidence was found which would indicate that the reported flying saucers were anything but the result of natural phenomena. On the other hand, all the evidence indicated that the reports of unidentified flying objects could be accounted for under three major headings. One, misinterpretation of various conventional objects. Two, a mild form of hysteria. Three, or simple hoaxes. It has been suggested that what people actually have been seeing is the result of some of our own secret experiments, guided missiles or new types of planes or flying weapons. This is emphatically not the case. None of the three military departments nor any other agency in government is conducting experiments, classified or otherwise, with disc-shaped flying objects which could be a basis for the reported phenomena.
On December 27, 1949, Project Saucer went out of existence. The flying saucers, however, refused to follow the project into limbo. Just possibly one of the reasons behind the stubbornness of the saucers to accept the mantle of oblivion was an article that appeared in True magazine just about the time Project Saucer was abandoned. It had previously been shown pretty conclusively that the number of sighting reports over a period of months usually followed closely the amount of publicity given to flying saucer observations. A lot of stories, a lot of sightings. Few stories, few sightings. Psychologists call this mass suggestion. But to return to the True magazine article printed in December of 1949, some percentage of the new wave of flying saucer reports can certainly be chalked off to mass suggestion. But again, as in the first reports, there remained that same unexplained percentage of reliable, trained observers who claim to have seen some object or objects wheeling, whirling, zooming, slicing, or hovering in the sky. Douglas Gourley of Laguna Beach, California, is an example. Here's his story.
I served 14 months as an anti-aircraft observer with a searchlight battery, and also 18 months as a seacoast and anti-aircraft observer with another searchlight battery. I was driving north March 21st on 101 Highway at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon when my attention was distracted by the sunlight reflecting off of some objects. I counted 8 of them proceeding directly out to sea at 2,000 feet altitude. They gave the appearance of being made out of aluminum, and I could observe a perfect circle outline of these craft. They were going, I would say, approximately 150 miles an hour. They were definitely a powered craft of some sort.
Here's a report from Selma, Alabama.
We were riding along the open country and had been observing a very beautiful sunset. And as the sun dipped over the western horizon, I looked to my right. And there in the sky were three small lights, which to me appeared to be three very small clouds. I looked steadily, and I said, no, they are not clouds, they are airplanes. Then I called my husband's attention to it, and he said, no, those are not airplanes, they are lights. And we observed them very closely. But being in motion ourselves, to us, they were motionless, because we didn't stop. But as we rode along, for something over a mile, they hung there in the sky, and they were, to us, had the appearance of tubes of fluorescent light, a beautiful, silvery, pink-tinged moonlight. And I said to my husband, that gives me a feeling that God is trying to say something to us. And we have had that feeling within us since.
By mid-March of this year, the flood of flying saucer sightings had hit a new peak. Into many of these reports, there now crept a new and somewhat eerie tone, the feeling that these flying saucers were something out of this world, possibly interplanetary aircraft, sent from some distant celestial sphere to investigate what manner of life managed to exist here on Earth. In line with this, we went to Dr. Donald Menzel, professor of astrophysics at Harvard University and associate director of the famous Harvard Observatory, to find out just how feasible any such idea might be. Dr. Menzel had this to say.
Well, I suppose that anything is possible, but I consider it extremely unlikely.
Well, what could these flying bodies actually be, Dr. Menzel?
Sun shining from a very distant plane, shining so that you could see that there was an object there, but the plane so far away that you couldn't hear it. Weather balloon. You have the bright round patch at fairly high altitude, sometimes three or four of them attached together. And then again, just pieces of paper carried aloft. When it gets up to 200 or 300 feet, you can't tell whether it's 100 feet or 1,000 or 10,000 feet away.
Prior to the middle of March, most observations, certainly all those which could be credited to reliable, sober sources, stated that the object seen was a good distance away, a distance that ranged from a few miles to 10 and 20. But on March 16th, a physician, a man who holds a private pilot's license, reported that he had seen some strange, unidentifiable type of flying body at close range. Dr. Craig Hunter of Berkeley Springs, West Virginia, had this experience.
We're going north on Route 153 from Clearfield, Pennsylvania, towards Penfield, Pennsylvania. And about 9 miles out of Clearfield, and I begin to hear a hissing, whistling sort of a sound, something that was completely strange to me. And then I looked up into the sky, and coming from a south easterly direction to a northwesterly direction, was this flying disc, or for the want of a better name, a flying saucer. It was, I would say, around 150 feet around in circumference, and there was three distinct parts of it. There was an inner circle, a metal circle, which rotated around this inner circle, and an outside circle, which about one-third of the area on each side was covered with openings somewhat similar to an airliner opening. Now, this inner circle rotated anticlockwise very slowly, and it went over me, practically right over my head, and I would say it was traveling at a speed approximately 60 to 70 miles per hour. I would say that the plane was approximately 250 to 300 feet above me, not over 400 feet. It was of a dirty aluminum color, and I got a tendency to indicate the southern edge as sloping up, which would indicate to me that it was about 15 to 20 feet thick at the center. It would give you the idea that it was a rocket type of combustion, rather. It didn't give you the indication of a make and break like a motor or anything like that. It was a continuous hissing, whistling sound. The conditions were very, very fine for observing it. I mean that it was just as clear as a bell, and I could distinctly see each and every detail as to the outline of it.
In order to check the whole question of design, to find out whether or not a saucer-like object such as the one described by Dr. Hunter could maintain itself in flight, according to the basic laws of aerodynamics, we call for the opinion of one of the nation's outstanding aeronautical engineers. Hall Hibbard is vice president and chief engineer of Lockheed Aircraft. And here is what he has to say over the beep recording telephone.
Well, my feeling is that that it is possible to build and fly something that looks like a saucer just from the technical standpoint, but I do not believe that there is such a thing at this time. I do not know of anything that would be considered in that category. I'm very familiar with pretty much what's going on in the way of research and development, and I know of nothing that would be considered as flying saucers or flying saucer material. You can make something that looks like a saucer fly, if anybody would ever want to do it. But I do not believe it would be possible with our present knowledge to have them make the speeds and everything that everybody has been talking about.
The flying saucer story came back into sharp focus on Monday of the present week. On that day, the United States News and World Report, a national news magazine, and Henry J. Taylor, a radio commentator, both came out with flat statements that flying saucers actually exist. Mr. Taylor said that there are two or more different objects that have been sighted and labeled flying saucers. One of these objects, the true flying saucer, according to Mr. Taylor, is a missile round in shape, varying in size from 20 inches to 250 feet in diameter. Some are guided, others are not. The U.S. News and World Report article mentions nothing about these objects. The magazine, however, describes a jet-propelled aircraft of revolutionary design that agrees in some details with Mr. Taylor's second secret aircraft, a piloted plane capable of high speeds and high maneuverability. Both accounts agree that the present models stem directly from the XF-5U-1, the so-called flying pancake, a small edition of which was built and flown in 1942. Last night, we put a special recording line into the home of Mr. Charles H. Zimmerman of the National Advisory Committee on Aeronautics, the man who originally designed the XF-5U-1. We asked him about the plane, whether it ever actually flew.
This aircraft never flew. The official designation of the aircraft was the XF-5U-1, which was to be a high-performance Navy fighter. However, a low-powered, lightly loaded version of this craft, called the V-173, made a large number of successful flights. I conceived the original idea for this craft back in 1933.
As a top plane designer, we asked Mr. Zimmerman
to give us his opinion as to whether or not a plane could be built that could hover like a helicopter, then take off at almost supersonic speeds. He said,
"It would be possible using modern turboprop engines to build a machine of this type, which would be capable of hovering and of also flying at all forward speeds up to possibly 550 or 600 miles per hour."
To follow through on the problem of whether or not disc-shaped objects could actually fly, we got in touch with Mr. David C. Prince, Vice President of the General Electric Company and Chief of its General Engineering and Consulting Laboratory. Mr. Prince was having no part of flying saucers.
"My thought is simply that the ability of some people to kid themselves is extraordinary. For instance, the effect of searchlights on clouds has been taken to be flying discs. Even radar evidence is not conclusive here, because rain in the clouds would show up on a radar screen. The only saucer-shaped aircraft which we know has flown, and that only a few times, is a propeller-powered disc developed by NACA. As a matter of fact, a cigar-shaped craft with a single revolving wing, jet-powered, could be faster and certainly would be much more maneuverable. In flight, this plane might look like a disc because of the halo created by its rapidly revolving wing. Such a craft would have flight characteristics similar to a hummingbird's."
Late this afternoon, we tried to tote up the score. On one desk, we had a pile of clippings, news reports, recordings of eyewitness accounts of flying saucer observations. We had the Taylor broadcast, the U.S. News and World Report article. On another desk, we had our Project Saucer report, the transcripts of our conversations with leading scientists and engineers, who, to use a gentle phrase, discounted the possibility of any such thing as a flying saucer. On that desk, too, was the news ticker dispatch from the United States submarine base at Key West, Florida, a dispatch that quoted President Truman's press secretary, Charles Ross, as saying that President Truman has no knowledge of any secret project by this government that would give substance to the existence of such objects. Ross also said that both the Air Force and the Navy deny that such objects exist. We tried to add it all up. We admit that now, as before we started our case, we have no opinion. The figures just don't add up. So we went to the public. We went to the man and the woman on the street to see how they were reacting to this barrage of positive sightings and just as positive denials. We wondered how they felt. They told us.
"Well, I think there's more to it than meets the eye, and I think it's more to it than what they're writing about.
Personally, I don't think such a thing exists. I don't see how it could.
I have a confidence that something on that order may exist. I lived in North Carolina in 1903 when the reporter for the New York World was fired for reporting that the Wright brothers flew.
Some say they're stars, some say they're enemy action, and all kinds of things, but I really don't know.
There must be something to it.
Purely what? Imagination. I didn't believe it at first, but now I'm beginning to believe it.
No such thing as a flying saucer.
Well, I believe President Truman, like the rest of us, has a right to his own opinion."
And now, just in case all this has added to the celestial confusion about your heads, we've summarized the data we've been able to gather, sorted out the points of agreement and disagreement among those who claim to have seen flying saucers. Here is what we found. Nearly all these observers are in agreement on the color of the objects. It's a metallic color, they say, something like aluminum or silver. Almost everybody agrees the objects are generally disc-shaped, but with wide variations, sometimes balloon-like or resembling a giant rubber ball. Still others describe them as elongated cigar-shaped things. Speed of the saucers has been estimated at from 0 to 1,200 miles an hour. And when we get into the question of maneuverability, the observers seem not to be able to find the precise or adequate words. They say that the saucers hover, accelerate, and decelerate rapidly. They say that some of the objects flutter, oscillate, drift, whirl, or float. There seems to be no fixed pattern of flight in cases where more than one or two discs have been reported. But several persons have said that in group flights, one of the discs seems to be of a distinct color, indicating, possibly, that this off-colored disc was the monitor or the control disc for the others.
A small percentage of the observers said the disks bore light. And in five cases, at points as far apart as Alabama and California, the viewers said the disks suddenly disappeared in flight. But when we get around to estimating altitudes at which the objects were sighted, we find that some observers say they saw them at 250 feet. Others guessed the disks were at 40,000 feet in the sky. While one observer estimated the number of disks seen at 100, nearly all thought the number was less than 10. And about half those who claimed to have seen the objects said they saw only single saucers. Well, these are the things men and women in various parts of the United States say they have seen in the sky. Men of science and high government officials cast a skeptical eye at these reported sightings of celestial phenomena. So far, in the course of this broadcast, there have been no reliable reports of the sighting of any new flying saucers. Frankly, we don't know the answer. We wonder, do you believe in flying saucers?
You've been listening to The Case of the Flying Saucer, a special report narrated by Edward R. Murrow. The Case of the Flying Saucer was based on extensive research collected with the aid of CBS-affiliated stations and CBS newsmen across the country. Portions of this broadcast were transcribed. This program was written by Irv Tunick, directed by John Dietz, and produced by Robert Bendick and Irving Gitlin.
And that was the late and great Edward R. Murrow from 1950, and is a really a nostalgic piece. And you're listening to WHFR.FM. I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. This is the station making waves. So when we return, we're going to see where ufology has come in the last 60 years, from speculation by journalists to admissions by well-respected scientists and astronauts. So stick around.
Well, howdy! Thanks for coming to Big Bubba's. We got a mess of used cars. What can we do for you?
We're looking for,
something cute.
Well, here's a beauty. A 99 model with a moonroof. As a bonus, we'll throw in a leaking gas tank. You could be driving and kaboom! Adds that zing of excitement.
You got any other cars?
Wouldn't it be great if you could be warned of life's risks? If you have diabetes, you can. There's a simple blood test called A1C that can help measure your risk of complications from diabetes. Why is it important? Because more than 600 people every day die from diabetes and its complications. If your A1C is above 7, your doctor can show you how to lower it. If you have diabetes, know your risk. Know your A1C. Ask your doctor, or for more information, go to www.diabetesa1c.org or call 1-877-TEST-A1C. Brought to you by the American Diabetes Association, Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation International, and the Ad Council.
Pat Frisco, inviting you to listen to the history of avant-garde jazz and creative improvised music on the Spirits Rejoice program every Tuesday from 6 to 10 p.m. on this radio station, WHFR Dearborn.
The Center for Lifelong Learning at Henry Ford Community College offers educational alternatives. Options include upgrading job skills, new career tracks, professional development, continuing education, or personal enrichment. And classes are affordable. Call to register at 313-317-1500. Henry Ford Community College, your best choice, guaranteed.
And this is WHFR.FM, the station making waves. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. And we're back with UFOs past and present. And you've heard from Edward R. Murrow from 1950. But in the late 1980s, the late astronaut Gordon Cooper chased UFOs while he was a fighter pilot in the U.S. Air Force, and later watched as one landed on the dry lake bed at Edwards Air Force Base. So I want you to listen to a clip from a TV special that was narrated by Jonathan Frakes. And here in his own words is the voice of the late Gordon Cooper.
The right stuff. But there is another side to Cooper's lifetime in aviation. One that for years he would only discuss with close friends, until now. It involves his personal encounters with UFOs. For him, it began in 1951 while flying in Europe for the U.S. Air Force. There, Cooper and other pilots witnessed an incident that has never been officially explained. A vast armada of UFOs flying in formation at extremely high altitudes. Recently, Yolanda Gaskin spoke with Gordon Cooper. In this exclusive interview, Colonel Cooper spoke for the first time on television about his encounters with UFOs.
I've read about this incident you had in 1951, and you said you saw literally hundreds of unidentifiable flying objects.
Yes, they were flying quite high. How high, we couldn't tell because we couldn't get anywhere near their altitude. But they were either very large craft way up or smaller craft still well above what we could get to.
For a day and a half, all of this happened. But then no one wanted to talk about it.
Well, we sent a report forward on it, and the answer that finally came back months later was they were probably high-flying seed pods, which didn't sound very logical.
There are always a lot of excuses. There's always the weather balloons. I've heard that one before. In 1951, you couldn't even get close to the things that were flying overhead. You or anyone else that was flying.
They were faster, higher.
6 years later, Cooper again encountered a UFO. This one definitely was not a weather balloon. While supervising flight testing in Edwards Air Force Base, his military camera crew actually filmed an unidentified saucer-shaped object landing near the site.
As they were sitting there filming, a little saucer came from, it was a saucer, came flying over their heads, put down three little landing gear and landed right out on the dry lake bed. And they picked up their cameras and started over toward it, filming as they went. And when they got in fairly close to it, it lifted up, put the gear back in the wheel wells, tipped up, and took off at a great rate of speed. And so they came into my office and told me what had happened, and I sent them over to develop the film. And then had to go through all the proper regulations of reporting this. And we wound up having to send the film forward to Washington in the base jet airplane. And I don't know whether anyone's ever seen it since.
Now, the vehicle that you just described, how similar was it to the very first sighting that you had back in 1951?
Quite similar. It was basically the same planform vehicle. They were a double saucer, lenticular. But if you're going to be going in and out of atmospheres like Earth or other places might have, you certainly need a little more aerodynamic type of vehicle. And the saucer has the capability of going through the air at tremendous rates of speed and handling the bow and trailing wave without making shock waves. So it can be very silent while traveling at big rates of speed through the atmosphere.
But sightings of UFOs weren't limited to the military. Cooper has commercial airline colleagues who've also seen UFOs.
Yes, a friend of mine who's a captain on a major airline, at night was flying along, noticed this, suddenly a big glow came off his left wing, and he looked out and this big saucer was sitting right off their wing. And so he turned slide toward and it moved away, and turned back and it moved back in position, and turned to his co-pilot and said, do you see what I see? And he said, oh God, yeah, I do. And it trailed along with him for quite a period of time, then tipped up, climbed very steeply away. Was on Jim McDivitt's Gemini 7 mission, where they saw this glint of something metallic off in the distance. And he reported, and nobody had it listed on the ground, so he tried getting a picture of it, but the sun, unfortunately, was glinting off of it so bright. All you got is just a glint. There was no detail on what it was. But never any further sighting at all on it.
Years later, Cooper approached the United Nations with a proposal for a committee that would explore the UFO phenomenon.
All right, now tell me about the letter to the U.N.
Well, the letter to the U.N. was in conjunction with a meeting that I had with Kurt Waldheim and the Security Council of the U.N. to try to encourage the U.N. to establish a committee to start comparing notes and data and information and to really look into all of this from an unbiased, neutral point of view.
Here's a quote from your letter. I believe that these extraterrestrial vehicles and their crews are visiting this planet from other planets and are obviously a little more advanced than we are here on Earth. And are you saying that's exactly why governments have been trying to keep this information private, because of that obvious advancement?
Very possibly, right.
And that was the late Gordon Cooper, astronaut Gordon Cooper. And more recently, astronaut Dr. Edgar Mitchell was interviewed on Kerrang Radio in the UK. And the host of the show, The Night Before is the name of the show, Nick Margerson. I don't want to get that name wrong. Nick Margerson asked Mitchell about the possibilities of life on other planets, and he was stunned by the reply. Nick Margerson and Kerrang Radio has graciously given me the permission to re-air that segment from his show. Once again, the name of the show is The Night Before. And whatever that means, I don't know. But he gave me permission to re-air it, so I'm going to play it for you here. This is the voice of Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon.
Oh, so you have to go further than that.
Do you believe in life on other planets?
Oh, yes. There's not much question at all, but there's life throughout the universe. We're not alone in the universe at all.
You're convinced that we're not alone in the universe?
Oh, I know for sure we're not alone in the universe. Now, have we been able to identify for sure where the other planets are? No, we have not. Certainly not in our solar system. But they've identified quite a number of planets now that very likely could be life-bearing planets. And I happen to be privileged enough to have be in on the fact that we have been visited on this planet. And the UFO phenomenon is real, although it's been covered up by our governments for quite a long time.
Whoa! Hang on a minute. Well, this is big. All of this is quite a shock to me.
Well, I'm sorry, you haven't been reading the papers recently. It's starting to open up quite a bit.
So you're telling me, well, there's a lot of information to take on board. Hang on a minute. I've heard, like, crazy UFO nuts tell me this kind of thing before. I've never had Dr. Ed Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon, a respected scientist in his own right, announced to me that we've been visited by aliens from other planets, and that they definitely are out there. There's no debating it.
Well, that's the first time you've ever talked to me, or I've told you about it before.
So you believe the whole deal?
There's more nonsense out there about this than there is real knowledge, but it is a real phenomenon, and there's quite a few of us. It's been well covered up by all of our governments for the last 60 years or so, but slowly it leaks out, and some of us are privileged to have been briefed on some of it. I happen to have grown up in whether you know this place, Roswell, New Mexico, where presumably the Roswell incident of 1947 took place, and I'm quite knowledgeable of the lore there, and since I grew up there. But I've also been in military circles and intelligence circles that knows beneath the surface of what has been public knowledge that, yes, we have been visited.
So, and be serious, you're not going to go, I was just pulling your leg about that. It's not true. I'm just wondering if I've stumbled upon astronaut humor, and in a couple of minutes you're going to go, I was only pulling your leg.
No, I won't say that.
Wow. So you've been briefed on the fact that there are, we've been visited.
Well, I have briefed is one word for it. I have been involved in much of this work. No, it's not my main work. It's not my main interest. But I have been deeply involved in certain committees and certain research programs with very credible scientists and very intelligence people that do know the real inside story, and I am not hesitant to talk about it.
What is the real inside story?
Well, I've just been telling you. We have been visited.
Are they, I mean, are we in regular contact, or was it a one-off crash, or...?
Well, no, there's been quite a few, there's quite a bit of contact going on. I can't tell you because I don't know all the extent of it. I don't know all the inside details because that isn't my really main interest. But the fact that we have been visited, the Roswell crash was real, and a number of other contacts have been real and ongoing, is pretty well known to those of us who have been briefed and been close to the subject matter.
So why is it being covered up then? Why is it that it's not mainstream?
Well, the reason for that goes back to the main instance really started taking place after World War II, when in the United States, at least, I can't speak for the European government or the South American governments, all of whom have recently started opening their files. And this is starting to open up, and just read the internet or look at some of the press, international press, you'll start to get the stories that are coming out now.
I've had people on the show telling me that that the governments are mounting up towards disclosure, towards saying that this is the case. Do you think it will be the case that there will be an actual disclosure on this, maybe this year, that the governments will come out?
I don't know whether it will be this year in the United States, but certainly we've already had it in the last few years from the Belgian government, the French government, the Brazilian government, the Mexican government. They've opened their files and admitted that they had the files.
Let me get my head together. Okay, listen, here's what I know. I've had people on the show talking about the fact that the Catholic Church has said belief in life on other planets doesn't compromise your Catholicism.
Of course, that just happened recently.
Yeah.
In association with a major release, I believe, of the British government, some of the British government files. They weren't their deepest files, but there were some files released.
Yeah. What's happening is, at the moment, over the next 4 years, all of the UFO files here in the UK are being released. Do you think it's the case that we are ramping up towards maybe the UK admitting?
Well, I can't say how fast it's going to happen, but certainly the public awareness of it is increasing. The public acceptance is increasing. The amount of misinformation and covert and attempts to cover up seem to be decreasing. I think we're headed toward real disclosure, and some very serious organizations moving in that direction.
You've had a long time to think about this. What do you think the impact will be on the world when it is finally mainstream news that there are alien beings that live outside this planet?
Well, I think at this point it's probably ho-hum, so what's new? I think that certainly in the United States, there's well over 70% of the people now accept this as fact, although they do not know the all the correct story. They do know that there has been, or accept the fact that there has been visitation and that there's UFOs in the skies all the time that are very likely alien craft. Now, not all of them are. I suspect some of them are homegrown. I suspect that in the last 60 years or so, that there has been some back engineering and the creation of this type of equipment, but it's not nearly as sophisticated yet as what the apparent visitors have.
So, as part of this, as part of you knowing about this, and also going public with it, are you worried for your own safety with this kind of stuff, or are you convinced that the...
Oh, no, I think those days are gone. That used to be a concern among the people on the inside, but I don't think they're knocking anybody off for that anymore or doing drastic things to them.
What do you think the intent of the aliens is? Is it hostile or peaceful?
No. It's not hostile. It's pretty obvious that if it were hostile, we'd have been gone by now.
Really? I mean, what...
We could have been.
Wow.
We had no defense, if that's what their real intent was.
And what are we talking, what do they look like? Are we talking like, you know, the traditional
You've seen some of the pictures. The pictures that I know of, some of them are these little people with that look strange to us. As far as I know from my contacts that have had contact, that's pretty accurate.
Wow. Do you think other people who were involved in the moon landings know about this?
Some of them do. But again, it's like other people, if you're interested enough to dig into it and want to know about it, you can know about it.
Because, man, listen, I know you're a busy guy, and I know there's other people who need to...
Yeah, this phone, they're not leaving me alone with this other phone that's ringing all the time, and I'm by myself here.
This has been easily one of the most significant conversations of my life. Unbelievable. I want to thank you for joining us.
You bet.
And Dr. Ed Mitchell, listen, you're a friend of the show, if you want to accept that friendship. Wow, what an incredible...
And that was Dr. Edgar Mitchell on Kerrang Radio in the UK. And I want to thank Kerrang Radio and specifically Nick Margerson for allowing me to re-air that segment of his show, The Night Before, is the name of the show. So, hey, listen, this is Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon, who's coming forward. And he was interviewed later by ABC and many others because this story, for some reason, went all around the world. That Dr. Edgar Mitchell says that we are not alone. The Roswell crash was real. He's been an insider and privy to documents and briefings on the subject, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And when he was interviewed later, he says, I don't know what the big stink is. I've been saying this for the past 10 years. And it's true. He has been saying this. Dr. Edgar Mitchell, was 2004, was scheduled to speak. That's when he was scheduled to speak at the MUFON Symposium in Denver, Colorado. And I was there, and the man had a heart attack and was unable to attend. But he did speak later, kind of a makeup, you know, do-over. And he spoke at the MUFON Symposium, and he's been saying the same thing for many years, that Roswell crash is real, UFOs are real, the phenomenon is real. I don't know what he said about alien abductions, but he has said that there have been UFO crashes, and the fact that people have, you know, we humans have seen these small gray beings with large heads and big eyes, and I think we are gearing up for disclosure, because you notice that UFOs and aliens, they might make a joke out of it now, but you see a lot of it in commercials and in television programs. I think that they're kind of indoctrinating us to disclosure, because like Edgar Mitchell said, all these other countries, the UK, Brazil, France, you know, they're coming out with Mexico has they were chasing the drug smugglers. They're doing patrol in Mexico a while back here, if you'll remember. It was a big news that they were doing their regular patrol, and these UFOs in ultraviolet light were seen pacing the plane and chasing the plane. And it's, oh, they're seeing oil well fires. Well, these objects were above the ground, in the clouds, coming toward the plane. You know, these oil wells out in the Gulf are not going to be chasing the plane. You know, but the funny thing is, some people would rather believe that there are oil wells in the sky chasing planes before they'll believe that there are other beings in this vast universe, and which is just amazing. Let me take a minute to read to you a little bio on Dr. Edgar Mitchell and on Gordon Cooper, kind of give you an idea of the credibility of these witnesses. As to Dr. Mitchell. Now let's go with Gordon Cooper first. Gordon Cooper received a Bachelor of Science degree in Aeronautical Engineering from the Air Force Institute of Technology in 1956, and an Honorary Doctorate of Science degree from Oklahoma City University in 1967. His honors and awards are far too numerous to mention here, but they include the Air Force Legion of Merit, the Air Force Distinguished Flying Cross, and the NASA Exceptional Service Medal. He was with the 86th Fighter Bomber Group in Munich, Germany, where he flew F-84s and F-86s for 4 years. He logged more than 7,000 hours flying time, 4,000 hours in jet airplane. He had flown all types of commercial and general airplanes and helicopters. On March 15th through 16th in 1963, he piloted the Faith 7 spacecraft on a 22-orbit mission, which concluded the operational phase of Project Mercury. Cooper served as command pilot of the 8-day 120-revolution Gemini 5 mission in 1965. And Colonel Gordon Cooper logged 222 hours in space. So here's a guy who's receiving all kinds of awards from NASA, from the Air Force, an astronaut, a pilot, who says, I've chased these things. I've watched them as they've landed on terra firma, and we got pictures of them, and they took the film and you know, fell through the cracks somewhere, which most of the time it does if you put it in the hands of the government or the military. Let's talk about Edgar Mitchell now. Dr. Mitchell was the pilot of the Apollo 14 moon mission and was the sixth man to walk on the moon. He obtained a Bachelor of Science degree in Industrial Management from Carnegie Institute of Technology in 1952. The following year, he joined the U.S. Navy, where he trained as a pilot. Later, he qualified as a research pilot and taught at the Navy's Research Pilot School. While in the Navy, he obtained a Bachelor of Science degree in Aeronautical Engineering from the U.S. Navy, U.S. Navy Postgraduate School, and a Doctor of Science degree in Aeronautics and Astronomics from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. So here's another man, a pillar of the community, a scientist, down-to-earth, down-to-earth person, the sixth man to walk on the moon is a down-to-earth person. But he's a national hero, for goodness sake, American hero. And after he made this proclamation that we are not alone and UFOs are real, Roswell was real, a lot of the media trashed him. And one guy even said, well, you know, if you go off into space, it scrambles your brains. You know, so there's a lot of scrambled brains out there. But there are also a lot of people like myself. I must have scrambled brains because I haven't been into space, but I saw a UFO park over my head for 15 minutes one time. And the thing is, you know, we're coming up here in 3 days. We're going to have a vote on a president, a new president. And I'm hoping that they will release some of the facts like other countries have done. And no matter how you vote, please get out there and vote. Okay? And if you have any questions or comments for me, You can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. And this show, as well as all the forum shows, is now being archived at WHFR's website. And click on the forum button on WHFR's homepage. We Are Not Alone is now archived at blackfaultradionetwork.com, as well as on my website, ufoimplications.com. So please stay tuned to WHFR for the best in alternative music. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Saturday of each month at 10 a.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
You're listening to 89.3 WHFR Dearborn. We're bringing you non-commercial radio from Henry Ford Community College. Good morning, my name is Bill Keith. It's 11 o'clock and time for Light from the Underground. It's a pleasure to be here with you on this Saturday, just before the election, and David is right. Please remember to get out and vote on Tuesday. I was watching newscasts today with the long lines of people that were doing early voting, and the idea is that there's going to be quite a few new people voting, and election lines may be long, but do your best to get out there and let your voice be heard. Right now, some music from Katie Curtis. She's covering the Death Cab for Cutie song, Soul Meets Body, here on 89.3 WHFR.FM. We're making waves.
I wanna live where soul